Muy buenos días. El Ministerio de Educación Nacional les da la cordial bienvenida a nuestra segunda jornada del seminario-taller Estrategias para el uso de objetos de aprendizaje y redes de alta velocidad, el cual se ha planteado en el marco del proyecto de uso de nuevas tecnologías y metodologías en la educación superior para congregar experiencias exitosas en materia de aprovechamiento y utilización de redes de alta velocidad y objetos de aprendizaje a nivel nacional e internacional, como un referente para la construcción, desarrollo y apropiación de dichos temas en los docentes e investigadores de la educación superior. Hoy el seminario girará en torno al tema de objetos de aprendizaje. En la mañana se presentarán diversas miradas y perspectivas desde el enfoque americano y europeo. De igual manera se presentarán las iniciativas que están siendo adelantadas por el Ministerio de Educación Nacional a través del Proyecto Nacional de Nuevas Tecnologías en Educación Superior. En la tarde se desarrollarán tres talleres complementarios dirigidos a docentes, investigadores y técnicos de las instituciones de educación superior. Los talleres serán liderados por expertos nacionales en cada uno de los temas. Saludamos a las universidades conectadas hoy. En Bucaramanga, la Universidad Autónoma de Bucaramanga. En Cali, la Universidad Autónoma de Occidente. En Popayán, la Universidad del Cauca. En Medellín, la Pontificia Universidad Bolivariana. Y en Barranquilla, la Universidad Autónoma del Caribe. Iniciamos nuestra jornada entonces con el Dr. Stephen Downs, de Canadá, y su presentación Objetos de aprendizaje, su uso, su potencial y por qué no están muertos aún. El Dr. Stephen Downs es investigador senior en el Consejo Nacional de Investigación de Canadá, al cual ingresó en noviembre de 2001. También participa en el grupo de investigación en e-learning del Instituto de Tecnologías de Información en Moncton, New Brunswick. El Dr. Downs se ha convertido en una voz líder en el área de objetos de aprendizaje y metadatos en Canadá. No olviden, por favor, preparar sus preguntas para el final de su intervención. Dr. Downs, bienvenido.
Gracias. Buenos días. On behalf of the government and the people of Canada, I'd like to drop my microphone. Try that again. On behalf of the government and people of Canada, I'd like to bring you the warmest greetings. It is a great pleasure and an honor to have been invited here to Bogota, and I think it would be very hard to match the warmth and generosity with which I've been greeted here. It's been a wonderful welcome, and I thank you. Today is the first of two talks that I will be giving at this conference. Very good translators, but loud. Tomorrow I'll be talking about learning object repository networks. Today the topic of my talk is learning objects, and as you can see from the title, their use, their potential, and why they are not dead yet. It's kind of a fun title, but what I'm going to do in overview is sketch the traditional theory of learning objects as it developed in the late 90s, outline some major criticisms of that theory that have developed in the last few years, and then talk about the new approaches for using learning objects that have developed in the last year or two among people in Canada and in Europe. Okay. I guess I was feeding into their sound system too. I want to begin by talking a wee bit about what a learning object is. I suspect that this may be a topic that is familiar to most of you, but I prefer to begin right with this concept. A learning object is intended to be a digital learning resource, and as you can see from the diagram there on the screen, you can see the typical structure of a learning object. It would be designed around a learning objective at the center. It would include elements of learning, of practicing, and assessment or testing. This learning resource would be surrounded by or referenced by a description in metadata describing what the type of learning object is, what the level of the learning object is, and other information about the learning object. And the idea of the design of the learning object is that it would be interoperable with a learning management system. There have been numerous definitions of learning objects over the years. I've drawn out three that have been most influential in the field. National Learning Infrastructure Initiative from the United States defines them as modular digital resources uniquely identified in MetaTag that can be used to support learning. The IEEE defines them famously as any entity, digital or non-digital, that may be used for learning, education, or training. And then David Wiley, narrowing the IEEE definition, defines them as any digital resource that can be reused to support learning. The essential properties of a learning object, there's been some debate about this over the years, but the idea of a learning object is that it will be a smaller unit of learning. It won't be a whole course or a whole program. It will be self-contained so that you can access a learning object in isolation and go from beginning to end and not necessarily need to have linked to previous course materials. It will be reusable in the sense that you can use it in one context and then another context. So you might use a math object in a math course or a science course or a physics course. It can be aggregated. That is to say, numerous learning objects can be brought together to form a larger unit, a module in a course or a whole course itself. And then tagged with metadata. That is to say, the learning object ought to be capable of being described in such a way that computer systems can read that description and analyze and organize learning objects accordingly. Norm Friesen, in his influential paper, What Are Educational Objects?, identified three essential properties of learning objects, and I agree with this. First of all, they have to be discoverable. That is to say, you have to be able to, within a short period of time, find the relevant learning object that you are looking for. If you are preparing a course on trigonometry, you need to be very quickly able to find the resources that are out there on the internet. They need to be modular in the sense that they fit together. I won't say like Legos, but they fit together in an organized fashion. And they need to be interoperable. The idea here is that a learning object can almost like plug into a learning management system or plug into other learning objects so that data can be shared between these objects. I want to outline from a theoretical perspective the traditional theory of learning objects. And there are five major aspects to this traditional theory: object-oriented design, course construction, open standards, a common language, and the specifications and standards. The original idea behind learning objects, and this comes from Wayne Hodgins and others who were working on the concept in the early 90s, is that a learning object would be based on object-oriented design. Those of you who are familiar with computer science and object-oriented programming will grasp the concept. The idea here is that you have a prototype. I'm pointing to my screen, you can't see, but the gray tree is a prototype. It's like an instance, a model of a resource, but with some of the details missing. And then what you do is you create a copy or a clone of the prototype, and then you fill in the details. And the idea of a learning object is that these learning objects would be these prototypes, and then when they were used in a particular institution, that the details would be filled in. So you would get things like institutional branding, or the name of the course, or the name of the professor, other things like that. The idea here, again from computer science, is that objects of this design could be used in rapid course design. The acronym RAD stands for Rapid Application Design. And it was a concept in computer science. And the idea was, you would have these bank of resources, and then you would drag and drop them. Those of you who have worked with Visual Basic or stuff like that, again, we'll have the concept where you can drag a toolbar and drop it on the screen, drag a menu bar. And the idea was that this would be done for learning resources as well. So you drag a trigonometry object, or as you can see from the diagram, you drag a model, drag some curricular stuff, whatever. The way these pieces would interoperate would be determined by a basic set of standards. And over the years, various standards evolved. Originally, organizations such as the Aviation Industry Computer-Based Training Committee, AICC, and IMS and the European Ariadne came up with specifications or first drafts of a set of metadata and other properties that would describe learning objects. These, over time, were used in various test beds and labs and became formalized into standards. And probably the most well-known of these standards is the IEEE Learning Object Metadata Standard. And so there exists now this IEEE metadata standard. It defines 87 or whatever different elements of a learning object that are used to describe the learning object and to support the interoperability of the learning object and the discoverability of the learning object with learning management systems and rapid course design systems. Underlying all this is the common language used to create this metadata. This common language is XML. I imagine many of you are familiar with XML. I've presented a sample of XML, and you may be familiar with the source. The book name is Bible or Genesis, and then chapter, and it's all broken down. And as you can see, the angle brackets indicate different parts of the description. This XML metadata, there are two major uses of this. The first use is to describe the properties, the name of the object, the author of the object, the publisher of the object, the educational level of the object, things like that. The second use, and it turns out to be a much less popular use, is to create the object itself. So the first chapter of the object, a part of a test of the object. In other words, the actual contents of the object. And the idea is that all of this would be done in XML, so all of this would be machine readable, and then the machines could make them interoperate together. And so we get these fairly complex systems, and I stress that. The instructional management system, the IEEE learning object metadata specification, and then a system developed or a standard developed by Advanced Distributed Learning in the United States for the United States military called the Shared Courseware Object Reference Model, or SCORM. And you can see in the diagram here how these learning objects were intended to work together. And on the web browser, they call them in this diagram assets, which is an interesting reading of it. But the idea is these assets or these learning objects would be joined together, and then some JavaScript, or as they call it here, ECMA script, would be used to communicate between the learning object and the learning management system, such as Blackboard or WebCT or Docent or Saba or whatever. So that's the traditional picture of learning objects. And you can sort of see from this diagram how people were thinking, how these learning objects would be used, created, and used. And so you would have, up in the factory at the top, the course authors or the learning object authors be creating stuff, and out would pop these learning objects, and then they go along the little conveyor belt there. And then an instructor working in a university creating a course will find the learning objects, grab the learning objects from a repository, and just plop them in order. Sorry, plop is a technical term. Plop them in order, or IMS learning design. You see that these specifications for the organization of learning objects are based on this ordering, this linear ordering, sometimes with branches of trees, of these learning objects. the output from this, the work that the instructor did, would all be assembled into what is called a course package. Course packaging is another one of these IMS specifications. And as you can see from this diagram here, the resources, the content is the learning object, and then you see the metadata describing the content. And then there would be a table of contents and other information about the course as a whole. And interestingly, all of this would be packaged. And the way they were thinking, the way IMS were thinking and ADL and SCORM were thinking, is that this could all be put on a CD-ROM or could be delivered over the internet. And the IMS course packaging specification actually specified that you would have all of these course packages as a package, and then it would be compressed or zipped, and so it would be very efficient to transport and move about. Interestingly, and this is a comment that I made to them, the course packaging specification had the major effect of making these inoperable on web browsers. So you had to use a learning management system in order to access the package, extract it, and display the separate parts. Here's another view, a different view, my own view, of how reuse may be accomplished. And again, you have the data, which is the actual information or learning content in a learning object, and the metadata, and this is all presented in XML. The overall construction of a learning object would be a long XML document. And then this XML document, when interpreted through different style sheets, could be presented to different systems. Could be presented as an HTML page, or plain text, or a PDF, or even something that would go on your mobile device, or your iPod, or something like that. I have to catch my breath a wee bit. I'm used to breathing air at sea level, and not Bogota level. Well, not too long ago, there was a much heralded death of learning objects. Because the concept, the picture that I've just drawn has, over the last few years, I know I move way too much for TV cameras, I'm sorry. You should see me when I'm not at a podium and cameras. I'd be wearing a path on the stage. And they sometimes attach wires to me, and so I sometimes pop the wires. Thank you. Over the last few years, I think even like starting about 4 years ago, but nobody was really listening then, but, and especially over the last couple of years, there has been a lot of criticism of this theory that I've just outlined. And I've outlined the theory so far in this talk without the criticism, but I want you to keep in mind that outline as I talk about some of the criticisms now. Probably the starting point of all of this was Norm Friesen's famous paper, Three Objections to Learning Objects. And his first objection, and this has been much discussed in the community, is that there's no common understanding of what a learning object is. If you recall the IEEE definition that I showed a few slides ago, it actually allows anything in the universe to be a learning object. And as Norm Friesen says, there's something wrong with a definition that allows anything to be a learning object. At a seminar in Toronto once, I demonstrated this by finding a piece of tissue paper and identifying it to the crowd as a learning object. And I made sure it was a used tissue paper, so it was reused. It was one of those demonstrations that people don't forget. Following from that, Norm Friesen asks, where is the learning in learning objects? When we look at the definition of learning objects, it's not clear that a learning object ought to or necessarily must incorporate pedagogical principles. And this is going to come back to haunt us in just a couple of moments. Dan Rehack wrote was quoted in a paper by Wilbert Cran and Scott Wilson that Dan Rehack Rehack was from Advanced Distributed Learning, an expert on learning objects, and he's sitting there saying to these people that learning objects, the way they're designed, might not be appropriate for use in higher education, like universities or schools, like kindergarten or grade school. And that sort of set the whole community to wondering, well, what are they used for? And this was the major point that Norm Friesen brought home, that the design of learning objects, heavily influenced as it was by advanced distributed learning and therefore the United States military, adopted a particular approach to learning. An approach that he said was appropriate to a military environment where when the sergeant says learn, you learn. But less appropriate to a university or a school environment. He writes, the obvious fact is that the goals of public education are radically different from those of the American military. And this is the diagram in his paper, and he quoted it from an ADL paper, or a Merleau paper, I should say, that really nailed home the argument. We look at this diagram, and Norm Friesen looks at this diagram, the rest of us look at it, and we say, is this the model that we had in mind when we were talking about reusable learning content? You see little jet airplanes and soldiers and things like that, and then a whole bunch of gears, and then it gets pumped into, you notice it gets pumped into a human brain and into a war fighter. And it's like, more like, you know, training manuals and indoctrination rather than learning. And so we look at this picture, and when we look at, you know, the mechanistic content delivery kind of model that learning objects embody, and we say, wait a second, this isn't what we meant at all. But there's more. The idea of learning objects is that they're supposed to be reused. But when you press, when you look at actual learning objects and press the question of what is meant by reuse, it becomes harder to see. Now, I'm not going to click on this example, but these slides will be available on my website later today, I hope, if I can upload them in time. And it shouldn't be a problem. Anyhow, these slides will be available on my website, and if you view these slides, click on this example, and you'll see what Alan Levine is talking about. What it connects to is one of these nice multimedia flash animations, and it does a bunch of nice things, and it presents some content and, you know, some moving images and stuff. And he looks at this flash animation and he asks, what can I do with this object? How do I reuse it? Does it plug in to a learning management system the way we all thought? And he looks at it and he says, no. It's just a flash animation. All I can do with it is link to it. And that's an odd sort of sense of reuse, isn't it? It's certainly, you know, the actual practice of learning objects did not follow this object-oriented rapid application design at all. Why not? This is from David Wiley. And David Wiley gained fame originally as one of the leading proponents of learning objects, and then earned a career award for a criticism of learning objects, and this is called the reusability paradox. And the idea here is, the more precisely you define a learning object, the less reusable it is. And think of it from the point of view of objectives. Remember in the first slide, at the very center of the learning object were these learning objectives. Well, if you define these learning objectives properly, then it becomes very difficult to reuse the object in different contexts, because the objective is related to or connected to the context of use. But if you make the object more general, more widely usable, then it becomes less and less of an educational object. Compare in your mind, for example, a part of a course in physics. I'm trying to think of part of a course in physics. I wish I had passed it. Let's try, no, not chemistry. Ohm's law. Okay, that's electricity. Right, but something in Ohm's law, and imagine, you know, imagine for yourself what a lesson in Ohm's law would look like, and what the learning objectives would look like, and how useful do you think this will be in an arts course, or in an English course, or in a drafting course? So they're limited reusability. But now imagine a learning object like a photograph, which can be reused in any of these applications, but a photograph has no learning objectives. Rory McGreal used to famously, he has this photograph that he goes around showing people. He says, this is a learning object. Where is it used? Where is it used? What are its educational objectives? And there are no educational objectives in a photograph. But a photograph can be a learning object, can't it? So there's this problem. And once these issues came out, the other issues came flooding in. Like I said, 87 fields in IEEE metadata. Norm Friesen's really in this. He did a study on the use of these learning object metadata elements, the 87 elements, and he found that only about 5 or 6 of the more basic elements are used, and all the rest of them aren't used. So all these metadata descriptions that are supposed to be used for discoverability and reuse, nobody's filling in the data. Copyright and digital rights management, and this came up a little bit yesterday. How do you know when you can use a learning object? How do you know when you can reuse a learning object? There's no mechanism in place for managing digital rights. Publishers would very much like to see digital rights enforced, but teachers and designers don't want to have to navigate through a digital rights management system in order to reuse content. So there's a lot of conflict there. Thank you. And next, could you bring a beer? You have to try, right? So what is the future of learning objects? Because we have this great plan, but we have all these problems, and quite frankly, I think that the model of learning objects as it was defined will not, cannot work because of these objections. I think these objections are successful. I think the original picture of learning objects was wrong, which is kind of hard for me to admit because I wrote a paper called Learning Objects, which had all of those things. But that's the way things go. Let's think about what doesn't work. We'll come back to David Wiley. The picture, remember this whole modular picture of learning objects where you organize them and assemble them? Wiley says, the idea of Lego-like assembly of resources simply will not work from a learning perspective. Daniel Lemire, who used to work with me at National Research Council and is now based in Montreal. People who create objects, the actual instructors who create objects, will not create highly reusable content. Think about when you are creating learning material for a class that you might be teaching. Are you thinking about, oh, how can I make this reusable in a trigonometry course in Africa? No, you're thinking, I've got a class in 10 minutes, I've got to do it now. I know how this works. Daniel Lemire says, you cannot easily package the work of teachers as Lego-like objects. You can't. And think about it. Even as I stand here, right, and I had my thing prepared, but I can't just simply take a talk that I did 2 weeks ago and play it. If I could, I would have just played a video for you, and everybody would be happy, right? But I came here to Bogota, and I came here to Bogota because the learning occurs in a specific context. There are particular applications that all of you have in mind. you were working in a particular educational culture that it was important for me to learn about and to adapt my talk to. And I can only do that at the time of delivery, not the time of creation. So let's refocus on what we're up to. Let's address the problems, as Scott Leslie says, that we're trying to solve. Namely, we want learning content that can be shared, and we need some way of finding this stuff. And if you think about it, we do want to be able to share things. There are ways that our work and our teaching can be made easier by sharing resources. But this needs to be easy to do. Look at what Norm Friesen says. The mechanisms that we use need to be simple, so that you don't need an entire course in learning theory or whatever, or computer science, in order to use them. The mechanisms that we use have to be compatible with existing systems. Certainly, I work with various instructors and designers, and they always ask me, well, can I use Microsoft Word with this, or will it work in PowerPoint? And when I talked to them about learning objects a number of years ago, and I said, well, no, it doesn't work with Word or PowerPoint. You need special software for that. And they turn off. They're not interested. They want something that will work with what they already do. And that makes sense, doesn't it? And it has to be easier. It has to give you an advantage. It has to make what you're doing less hard to do. Make it faster, more efficient, more effective. You need to be able to see how this improves things for you. So, what we need is some way to meet the objectives of learning objects, the discoverability, the reusability, even the modularity, but in a simple way, in a compatible way, something that we can use with web browsers that we already have and software that we already have, and make all of this very apparent, very visible to teachers, trainers, and I would also say to students and to the public as a whole. And so we get the story of syndicating learning objects. This is a photograph from a presentation that was done by Alan Levine from Maricopa College in Arizona, as well as Brian Lamb from the University of British Columbia and Darcy Norman from the University of Calgary, sometimes known as the Three Amigos, which is kind of interesting. And what they describe in the presentation, and you can see the link there in light blue on white, sorry about that, is a mechanism of creating and sharing learning objects that does not require a large technological infrastructure. And in fact, it can be performed by anybody who has a computer and a web browser and internet access. Here's where we begin. And I always like to ask this, how many of you here are familiar with RSS? If I just get a hand, show a hand. That's pretty good. That looks like maybe 20%. RSS is one of these. Remember I showed you the system of how standards get formed? You have the specification, you go through all the way to IEEE and that. RSS did not develop that way. RSS was created by a company called Netscape, which you may have heard of. And they created it in 97, 98, and then they abandoned it. They said, this isn't going to work. But enough people had started using it, I was one of those people at the time, that they picked up RSS and they kept using it. But now there was no standards body, there was no company behind it, there was no organization at all. It stood for, really simple syndication, or rich site summary, or RDF site summary. Now think about this. This is a standard that nobody can agree to the name of. And that's the way the standard developed. It was a horrible mess. It was chaos. But it was so simple that anybody could use it. And that's what began to happen. If you look at this diagram here, you see that RSS is a type of XML, just like the rest of these standards, except really there's only three elements. There's the title of a resource, there's the location on the World Wide Web of a resource, and then optionally, there's a short, it'll never stop waving, a short description, it's 3D. Sorry, I couldn't resist. I've never given a 3D presentation before. I should make you all wear those little glasses, those 3D glasses. But then I, in person, would be, what, 4D? Yes. A description of the resource, optionally. Here's how RSS works. Originally, RSS was intended for the use of news organizations like newspapers and magazines. Over time, it came to be used by any content site that produced new bits of content regularly. And today, most famously, RSS is used by blogging software. I'm just curious, how many of you have heard of blogs? Okay, about the same. I forgot to wait for the delay. Everyone's heard of blogs. Every blog that you see produces an RSS file. And with the title, the location of a blog post, and a short description or a long description, again, nobody can agree on that. And the idea is, so you have the news item or blog post, and then the RSS metadata that describes it. And what happens is, a piece of software called an aggregator goes to all of these different sources and aggregates or brings in the metadata. It brings in this title and this link and this description. And then it organizes it in different ways. There are many different aggregators. And so what happens is a user, a reader like myself, will access this aggregator. And I'll get a list of the titles of these articles from all of these different sources. And if I see a title or a description that I like from the RSS feed, I'll click on it, and that will retrieve the news item from the original source and present it to me on my headline viewer or on my web browser. Now, this is a very different picture, isn't it? Remember the learning objects? They all had to fit together, and they were packaged and zipped and put on CD-ROMs and all of that and delivered like they were parcels in the mail service. Well, this system, the resource, doesn't go anywhere until somebody asks for it. And the only thing that gets distributed around is the metadata. The metadata is actually separated from the resource. And that allows for a much more efficient mechanism for gathering and organizing indexes or search services for these content items. I've done a lot of work in RSS, and a lot of the people who have been working on learning objects, including most of the people I've quoted in this presentation so far, have been working on learning objects. So, there we go. This is a service called EduRSS. It's an aggregator, like I've just described. It's a piece of software that runs on my website. You can just run them just on an ordinary website. You know, you don't need big, huge systems. So I just run this on my website, and this aggregates or brings together RSS information from about 300 or 400 educational technologist blogs or websites. I access blogs, news services, BBC News, CNN, magazines like e-learning magazine, whatever. And let's see what we've got, because I don't know what's here. Because this listing, this is from, well, the last half hour. When I started this talk, these resources probably weren't here, but now they are. So, okay, we got a bunch of stuff from the Chronicle of Higher Education. They just published this morning. And what have we got here? Changing Assumptions in Best Practices. That's from EDUCAUSE, which is a major United States organization. More from EDUCAUSE, Lessons for the Future Internet, Learning from the Past. Oh, that'd be a good thing to do. And you get the idea, right? So Chronicle Educause, which is this U.S. organization, online learning update, talking about learning objects in Angola. The Associated Press, talking about teachers in Michigan wanting to teach students in Las Vegas. There's a CogDog blog, Alan Levine, and something, we don't know what, because it didn't translate properly, is back. Flickr Photo, it's back, okay, and more from Alan Levine, U.S. Department of Education. You get the idea, right? Look how easy this is. Imagine I am a professional in online learning. And I need a good way to keep up every day to do my own personal professional development. It would be really hard to beat something like this. I go through this. EduRSS will aggregate maybe about 100 items in a day. And you just saw we went through about 10 or 15 of them that quickly. I can look at EduRSS while I'm having breakfast and be completely caught up. And in fact, that's what I do. I have my breakfast, I have some eggs and some toast and a lot of coffee, and I have my computer, and instead of reading the morning newspaper or watching, well, I watch the news too, but I look at EduRSS and I say, oh, what happened last night? And I'm completely caught up before I get into work. You look like a genius when you do that, but really, it's simple. I've also created a site called DLORN. That stands for Distributed Learning Object Repository Network. And the idea of DLORN is it functions exactly in the same way as EduRSS, except instead of blog posts and news articles on educational technology, DLORN aggregates RSS feeds of learning objects. Now, one of the things that we've managed to do in the last few years is to convince major learning object repositories like EDNA and in Australia and Merlot in the United States and various others, Terrio in Canada, to create RSS feeds for the learning objects that they contain in their repositories. And so DLORN, well, I won't click on it because I don't want to take too much time, but what DLORN does is it aggregates these learning objects and then it organizes them by topic or by subject. So imagine now that you are a chemistry professor and have passed your chemistry courses, unlike me. You wake up for breakfast and you get all the resources, the new learning resources in chemistry. And as more resources come online, and more coming online all the time, we can get very precise and very filtered so that you can get all the resources that are new for the third week of second year organic chemistry. And that becomes a very powerful tool. And you don't have to go searching for it. These things come to you. Okay. How does that address the learning problem? Because remember, this whole thing about learning objects, right? It wasn't going to work because it's pedagogically, it doesn't work. You can't put the learning objectives and all of that in. Well, think about how learning happens. Think about how you're learning now. It happens in a context. It happens in a certain place and a certain time. There is an event or a process that constitutes learning. And this is always going to be the case. Whether you learn online, whether you learn in a classroom, whether you learn in a tractor or in an engineering lab, there's a context in which the learning is happening. And so, when we ask, where is the learning in a learning object, people always thought that the learning had to be in the object. And that, I contend, was the major design flaw in the original conception of learning objects. And that the learning in a learning object occurs in the use of an object. Now, what does that mean? I want you to think about this presentation. I've designed this presentation very deliberately. And if you look at what you've seen so far, you saw different pictures and graphs and graphics and bits of text. And the way I did this is I accessed my own website, And I looked up learning objects on my own website. Remember, I have EduRSS bringing all of this stuff in for me. And I found in my own repository things that would be useful and interesting. And I went, right-click, copy, paste into PowerPoint. What I did is I found reusable learning resources that were out there. They weren't designed or anything like that. They were just pictures and text and stuff. And I pasted them into my presentation. This whole presentation has been a series of reused learning resources, hasn't it? But the learning did not happen until I came here, put these things up on the screen, and started talking about them. But look at it from my perspective now. I mean, I give lots of these talks, and there are different ways you can do these talks. Some people go out and they do a talk in education. They have their talk, and it's a canned talk, and this is the talk that they give to every conference. Me, I get bored if I do that. So I try to do a different talk for every conference. So what I do is I prepare, as Diego knows, at the very last minute, and I sit down and I prepare my talk, and it takes me a couple of hours maybe, and find my resources and just organize them. And then I know that when I come to a talk like this, I have my resources, I have my presentation, so I have an order and a structure, and then I can work from that basis to adapt a talk specifically to an audience. And that is how learning objects ought to be used, both online and in person. Now, if you think about it, though, I've also, this microphone that I dropped, that was an accident, at the beginning of the talk, and I'm about to drop again if I'm not careful, and this backup, because my computer wasn't working, are recording this talk right now. I hope. No. So this computer is running a program called Audacity. Audacity is free open source software, and what it does is it allows me to do a sound recording, and it will allow me to record a talk of pretty much any length. I could, just depends on the size of my disk. So I could keep talking for 24 hours, this would keep recording. You would all leave, Audacity would keep going. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my slides, I'm going to take my recording, I am going to, probably later today, upload them to my website. And I will, in essence, blog them. I'll create a blog post for these things. So that'll create some RSS metadata. So people out there later today will be able to look at my slides and listen to the course or listen to the talk almost at the same time that it happened. If I was really ambitious, I could be doing this live. I could be Skype casting it so that people around the world could be listening to this now exactly at the same time I'm talking. I might try that tomorrow. We'll see if, because I haven't tried that yet, but I think that'll probably work. The idea here now is other people can come take my talk, my slides, right-click, and paste into their own presentation. And tomorrow, somebody who's giving a talk in Prague or Madrid or Beijing can be reusing the learning content that I just created. Now, you heard some talk in some of the talks yesterday, learning objects costing $20,000 or whatever. I don't even know what that is in pesos. I don't want to imagine. But this is free. This cost me nothing to create. $0. And remember how learning objects on the traditional conception were only used to be organized in courses, right? The U.S. military training manual way. But learning occurs everywhere. Not just in a classroom, not just when you're taking a course. The picture that we have of learning is if you're a farmer in your field and you're in your tractor and you're planting some seeds, your tractor can become your learning delivery system and you can learn in your tractor. Or if you're working on an engineering application and you have some highly specialized engineering software, your specialized engineering software can access learning resources. Something that was created yesterday is now available in your engineering software today. I do these things in PowerPoint. I am terrible at PowerPoint. I'm famous for like really bad slideshows. What I want is a way, when I'm trying to create something in PowerPoint and I want to know how to make my image like not go off the edge of the slide, because it always does, I want to be able to right-click and access a learning object, how to make your images not go off the edge of the slide. Why not? Here are some examples of places where these very mobile, reusable, simple reusable objects can be found. Electronic Performance Support Systems, what's his name? Chris Levy, I think from Harvard, is always talking about this. Or is it Chris Levy? I forget. Should have put that on there. This set of examples came from a post by Harold Jerky. He grabbed this post from, I'm not going to be able to see it, am I? From a site called greenworks.org. So this is the third time this list has been used, right? That I know of. Workplace design, knowledge management systems should also be learning systems. Just-in-time support. If you have a person doing customer support and they're on the telephone or they're at the front desk of a hotel or a restaurant, they should be able to access resources that they might need on the job that help them learn as well as provide better service. Communities of practice. I talk sometimes about the way people who communicate online, sending messages or discussion board posts, they use these objects, these pictures and these diagrams, they use them, they send them back and forth to each other. They don't organize them into a course. The learning occurs in the posting of this thing to a discussion list, in multimedia, like the slideshow, and so on. Where is this going? Right. We are right now, in my opinion, on right at a change in the paradigm of how the internet itself operates. We are moving from the old internet, which was structured, which was like a broadcast system. We broadcast and tell you what to think, you consume, to what is called Web 2.0, the interactive web, the web as platform. The place where content is created, not by content publishers, not by expensive designers, but by everybody. I talked about blogs already. Anybody today can create a blog for free if you have internet access. You go to a site like blogger.com or livejournal.com and you blog. And I want to show you the power of this. So I'm going to go into this ELGG link. That's just to get on the web. And now I'm going to... I didn't have very much time yesterday, unfortunately. So I didn't do the job that I wanted to do. And... Okay. Don't know what that says, but... La-di-da-di-da-di-da. Accept her. When the computer asks you if you accept something, you accept. Okay, that's a line from Ghostbusters. You were here yesterday. You remember the talks that you heard yesterday? All right? I was here. I was sitting right over there. I was actually kind of occupying two seats because I'm very large. I sometimes take up way too much space with all my gear and stuff, but, isn't that interesting? Here is the first talk by Javier Botero Alvarez. I'm sorry, I'm not good at pronouncing it. I've been working on it, though. This is the summary of the talk. I took notes during the talk yesterday. And then during the fourth talk, I uploaded these notes because I had web access. So I just simply went, in fact, I'll show you exactly where I went. Nuevo Ventana, por favor. I wonder if they translated that into English. I'm going to have to log in here. On my computer, I'm already logged in. So now you're going to see the back end. It's kind of cool, actually. What's my password? Too many passwords. I hate passwords. When the internet says see or no, you say see. Right? So here are the different blogs that I have. And so yesterday, while I'm sitting there, I went to this page and create a new blog post. And it's going to take a couple seconds because it's being slow. And I started typing. I just typed. As he talked, I typed. And then when I was done typing, I clicked Gardar como Barador, or Publicar Entrada, which means publish post. And I clicked Publicar because I don't like drafts and I don't never rewrite stuff. So, and it published. And as soon as I hit that button, it was available to the rest of the world. And what's really significant is, as this conference was still going on, people around the world were reading this coverage, and I haven't been online yet today, so I didn't know this, but somebody has already responded to it, I think. Yeah, here's a comment. I'm glad that Stephen is enjoying Colombia. Yeah, me too. I was in Bogota about the same time last year. And so now this person has added more information. Look at all these links. Right? Now, imagine somebody out there who is accessing an RSS aggregator. This conference took place yesterday. Yesterday, this shows up on their screen. And if they're studying Columbia, or they're studying learning objects, or they're studying information and communications technology, it doesn't matter, it shows up. And all of a sudden, because of what I did, very simply and easily there, sitting in my chair for free, it cost me nothing, it costs them nothing, now they are learning about something that took place right here, right now. And so I did all the rest of the talks, right? And actually, I don't have it here. I took pictures. You may have seen me sneaking up and bothering people with the flash. I took pictures, and what I had intended to do was to upload those to Flickr. Flickr is a site that will allow me to put my photographs on the internet. And again, I have a login here, and Flickr was bought recently. Flickr, by the way, is a Canadian company. It was bought by Yahoo. So what happened is it made some Canadians rich, and now it's an American company. That's how we do things in Canada. Don't remember me. Notice it's all in English. There's no Spanish translation. When the website says sí o no. So this is my Flickr account, and here are my photos, and you might as well see one photo that I took recently, and this one I've already made available to people, and you might recognize this. It's going to be a bit slow, I don't know why, but Flickr's been slow the last couple of days, and there it is. That's the view from the hotel in downtown Bogota, and if you don't like that picture, that's okay. Bogota is, in fact, a very large city. Again, I made this available to everybody in the world 2 days ago. And so people around the world have been following the course of this conference and have been able to access these learning resources, these resources that I created for free as I sat there in the audience. And the important and the central point here is that anybody can do this. You do not need to be an expert in learning objects or computer technology or object-oriented design in order to create learning resources. And what happens when Web 2.0 takes over, the authors of learning resources are no longer the experts necessarily. Think about what would happen if your students were able to author the learning resources. And students being students, a lot of them might not be very good, but some of them might be very good. And we're seeing this now, more and more high quality resources being produced by the students themselves. Why pay these expensive learning resource designers? They don't like it when I say that, but tough. Acceptar, of course. I don't know what that, but I know what that meant. So you've seen Flickr. I can do the same thing with audio. Odeo is a site that if I was accessing Odeo, I could be uploading this sound live right now as I talked. I could upload video at YouTube. I don't have time to show you, but remember yesterday we saw these talks about Internet 2 and broadband and all of that? You don't need that. You just need the connectivity that you get in your typical ADSL, and you can access videos from all over the world. Okay, there was something in the translation I must have missed. Ways of creating content. Ways of creating content collaboratively. All right. I guess the translator is moonlighting as a stand-up comedian. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I always like to have a dialogue with the translators. Because we're kind of in this together, aren't we? They're waving. Collaborative bookmarking. When I find a resource, I make a little, on your browser you can make a bookmark, but if you go to a website like Delicious or Furl, you can make a bookmark, and now you're sharing that bookmark with a whole community of people. These online applications like Writely. Writely is like a word processor, but the way Writely works, it's not just you and your computer. Other people can be working on the same document at the same time. And then, of course, you can share it using RSS. Aggregators. There are a lot of aggregators beginning to come online now. Aggregators for literary blogs. Aggregators from life sciences blogs. My own EduRSS. And just recently, and this is why I wait till the last minute to prepare these talks, in the last week, a website in Britain launched called Intuit, which does this. It does its aggregation and organization of learning resources in the way that I described for DLearn. And unlike DLearn, Intuit was written by professional programmers. So it works really well. And Graham Atwell just last night was saying, this is a learning object repository the way it was supposed to be designed. And I agree. And it uses aggregation. I will be talking a lot more about the mechanisms and the principles of content aggregation when I talk tomorrow. Finally, where we're moving now is into a domain called WebTops and personal learning environments. Right now, students access online learning through learning management systems, but that's learning the way it was designed by an institution. And also, it's very expensive to buy a learning management system, isn't it? The idea of a WebTop is that it's a personal view on the subjects that you're taking or that you're interested in. And there's a bunch of people, including myself, working on something called the personal learning environment. The idea here is that new forms of learning are enabled by this content network. It's not simply the way the LMS presents the content in a line. It's not linear. It's not sequential. It's not this simple sequencing or this learning design. Rather, it's a network of content and of users. And so the type of learning changes. It's not the U.S. military type of learning. It's the learning in context, learning in a situation, learning as you are doing kind of learning. This is a very famous picture now. It was originally created by Scott Wilson. It's gone through a few different iterations that people have played with it. The idea is that the personal learning occurs in the center. That's the future VLE. Scott's British, so he said VLE. That's the personal learning environment. And then you access all of these distributed resources around the web. You access your blogging site. You access Flickr. You access YouTube. You access content produced by a university. You access content produced by the Ministry of Education. All of these different content sources are made available. They're indexed in RSS, and your VLE brings in only that content that is directly relevant to you. And as you can see, the writing is very small. The protocols, or the standards, are these messy, ground-up, non-standardized standards. RSS, or a version of RSS called Atom. A way of describing individual people called FOF, or friend of a friend. Others, the Flickr API, a portfolio specification that nobody knows what it looks like yet. These sorts of things, these very simple XML standards. Personal learning environments. Right now, as you can see, this is, think about how that learning object was created, right? So who is that? It's Darcy Norman in Calgary, and just one day he's sitting down thinking about what should a learning personal learning environment look like. So he starts drawing on the whiteboard, and he thinks, oh yeah, that's about right. He takes a picture of it. He posts it to Flickr. He takes the Flickr thing, posts it to his blog. It shows up in AGURSS. I think, good picture. Right click, paste into this slideshow, and there it is, and now you're looking at it. And now you can access this slideshow, right click on that picture, and use it in your own class. Or not. Or you might just like pictures of aliens. Your personal learning environment, we've been thinking, might be this. This is a USB stick. It holds, I forget how much this one holds, data traveler, I don't know. Oh, here we go. Oh, this is 512 megabytes. I've got one at home that's 10 gigabytes. I didn't take that one on the road. Because I lose things like this really easily. Your personal learning environment could be on this. All the software that you need, your web browser, which of course will be Firefox because it's open source and free, and not Internet Explorer because it's not open source and unsafe. And it'll be your access to Flickr, it'll be your personal profile, it'll be links to your aggregators, and so on. And you go to a cyber cafe, or you go to a computer lab, or you're doing a presentation, you plug it into your computer, and your computer, wherever you are, whatever it happens to be, has become your personal learning environment. We have the technology now. We know how to do this. We've built some of these. This is something that I built. This is what a personal learning environment looks in my mind. Well, my mind has translated through my very bad programming. And the personal, what this is, this is again, it's on my website. It just runs on an ordinary computer. And the sizing is a little bit off. What this will do is this will access different RSS feeds from different things that I've created. And so we're seeing stuff from my blog, and we're seeing stuff from my website. Let's see how far down. And there's that picture. Remember that picture of Bogota that was on Flickr? Oops, I didn't mean to click on it. So, oh, geez. I really don't like these pads. I'm almost done. Those of you who are worrying that I'm taking too much time, this is like my last slide. Right. And it would be faster if I was better. So I'm going to take this, and what I'm going to do is I'm just slowly drag and drop it. Oh, come on. All right, pretend this is... Well, no, I really want to do the picture. It's just... There we go. Yeah, why not? Which one is copy? Copier. Paste is... Headgar. Right? So now, my picture of Bogota that I took the other day and posted to Flickr has been uploaded. And am I not going to be able to get into this? Yes, I am. Good. There we go. I have another blog called Yukon Mania, because I created it first in the Yukon. Oops. Backspace. Now, everybody hide your eyes. Now it should submit. Like I said, I'm not a very good programmer. Actually, more accurately, I'm a very lazy programmer. So that now, well, that's doing its thing. Oops. Right, I'm on Internet Explorer. That's why everything's going weird on me. Okay. Use Firefox, really. I mean, seriously, it's a much better browser. Here is Yukon Mania. This is my blog. And, oh, it hasn't posted yet. I wonder why. It should have posted by now, and usually it does, but I think this is being slow. It's real fast with Firefox. Anyhow, this will come up in a few minutes. The point here is, and of course, naturally, anytime you demonstrate something that you wrote in software before a live audience, something unfamiliar will cause it to fail. But that's okay. The idea here is the personal learning environment is not just a place you read content. The personal learning environment is a place where you aggregate content, but then you move the contents to a writing area. You work with the content. You make something new with the content. What was a learning object yesterday becomes a resource for a brand new learning object today. Nah, still not loaded. Oh, well. It'll show up eventually. And the idea is now, and what I would do, I'd take that picture of Bogota, I'd write maybe something personal reflections, or I'd add other pictures of aliens. I would take content from multiple sources, combine it in this one area, and create something new. And now, just think about that concept, and think about all the different ways you could create new types of learning using that basic idea. Because I've used a plain ordinary content editing field, but I could put anything there. I could have a specialized application. I could have forms. I could have a simulation that reads in and I work with, and that uploads the stuff. All kinds of things. Okay. As you can see, we're on the end of something old. We're at the end of learning and learning objects as the authorities presenting and people consuming. And we're at the beginning of learning objects as something highly mobile that everybody gets to create and everybody gets to use. And that's the new and evolving picture of learning objects. I thank you very much for your patience. I hope I didn't go too long over time. I'm sorry. I really appreciate you've been a great audience. Thank you very much.
Vamos a abrir entonces la sesión de preguntas. Vamos a utilizar la misma mecánica de ayer. Tenemos dos micrófonos ubicados en la parte de abajo, uno en la parte de arriba. Las personas que tengan una pregunta, por favor, levantan la mano, les entregamos el micrófono, se presentan y la hacen. Tenemos aquí la primera pregunta, por favor.
He's miming it. That was for the people. I'm still recording the audio.
Buenos días, muchas gracias. Yo quisiera su opinión personal sobre la diferencia que existe con lo que se está planteando ahora entre los DLL, que son las propiedades de derechos intelectuales, en lo que es toda la tendencia open source. El ámbito educativo es complicado porque muchas veces los estudiantes se copy-paste. Evidentemente la perspectiva que usted presentó en su conferencia es muy loable y es muy entendible, pero esto puede generar otro tipo de inconvenientes. Hoy en día empresas como Adobe invierten muchos dólares en programas, en que está la obra de SQL Policy Server, donde ellos a través de Google pretenden evidentemente mantener el derecho de autor. La filosofía o la perspectiva que usted ve del futuro de esto en cuanto a la protección de derechos y en cuanto a lo que sería el futuro de los objetos de aprendizaje fácil. Gracias.
Okay, that's an excellent question. Sorry. It's kind of weird to hear my own words back in Spanish right away like that. I wish I could do that. I could do both, right? The question for those of people who are listening by audio was about digital rights management and the tension between companies like Adobe that have designed systems to protect digital rights management and of course the rights of content creators, and then the tendency of students to right click and paste into their presentation, much like I have. And, you've asked the very top the very top tip of a very complex question, and I've done a lot of work in this area. I've designed what's called a system called Distributed Digital Rights Management, DDRM. And if you look that up on Google, you'll be able to find a much more detailed description of that. I have two streams of thought. The first stream, and I'll be very upfront, frank, and forward about this. I support open source and open content. And I support it because I believe that it's the only way that we can provide educational materials to a mass audience. Right now, we are in a position, particularly, you saw how easy it was to create content, right? Now, we are in a position where the value of content, the value of intellectual property is preserved only by creating scarcities in that intellectual property, only by making it hard to obtain, right? So that there are a limited number of sources. Look at the field of online music, for example. And, of course, you have the students, again, are trading songs left, right, and center. And the music publishers, what they do is they set up these legal digital rights-enabled online content, online song services. But if you analyze these, you understand that there's only 10,000 songs available. There's only their top 10 artists. And all the millions of independent people who create music are not able to get their content into this system. It's only for the product of the publishers. And what the publishers have done is, by setting up these walls, they've created an artificial scarcity of music. And that's how they can charge 99 cents for a song. But if everybody who created music was allowed to put their content into this common marketplace, the actual price that you could charge for a song, a good song, might be maybe 1 cent, might be maybe 1 peso. And all of a sudden, if you open up these walls, songs become available to everybody. So that's the one stream. The second stream is, how do you make this work? How does this happen? Because so far, nobody has really been able to implement an alternative to what they've been doing, the closed digital rights networks and the open free sharing networks. There are many mechanisms for open sharing. In the world of software, there are the open source licenses, and the open source license accompanies the software. In content, there is something called Creative Commons, which may be familiar to many of you. And what Creative Commons is a mechanism by which the author of some content can indicate that this content may be freely shared. Now, what's very important is Creative Commons, what that means is the author or the creator of the content continues to own the content. It is still their content. And what they are doing is they're saying, this is my content, but anybody can use it. And Creative Commons also allows this use to take place sometimes, depending on the content creator's desire, under certain conditions. For example, the content creator may say, this content may only be used non-commercially. Or they may say, this content may only be used if you give me credit for creating it, if you attribute it. Now, the part that what lies underneath Creative Commons is an XML description of this statement, the license itself. On my website, you'll see that all of my content is under a by attribution non-commercial license. So you give me credit, you use it non-commercially, you can use my content for whatever you want. If you look at my website, in the source of my website, you'll see some XML where this license is declared. This XML is what is called digital rights expression. There are different ways of doing digital rights expression. Creative Commons is one way, or using a specialized digital rights language like Open Digital Rights Language is another way. And this is Renato Ionella and Suzanne Guff and some others. And the idea here is you can specify the usage conditions very precisely, either commercial or non-commercial, either free use or to charge money for it. And you can express it in this XML. So the idea here is that the aggregators, when they aggregate content, can also aggregate the license. And so some aggregators aggregate only free content. Other aggregators aggregate commercial content. And so when you are looking at the list of content in your personal learning environment, you also have access to the usage conditions. So your personal learning environment knows, without you having to do extra work, whether or not you are allowed to right-click and paste that into your document. That's the very short description of the system. And again, if you look up distributed digital rights management, DDRM, you will find quite a bit of description on my website outlining such a system. And that those are the two threads of my answer to that question. A very important question. Hang on. All right.
Más preguntas, por favor, tenemos una en la parte de arriba.
Quisiera preguntarle lo siguiente. ¿Existen diferencias o características o estándares que nos permitan diferenciar objetos de aprendizaje para la educación presencial, para la educación a distancia, con soporte presencial, para la educación virtual, totalmente virtual, que nos permitan decir, bueno, este objeto de aprendizaje sirve, aplica y presenta las características suficientes para poder ser usado en cada una de estas?
Okay, the question was, the question was, is there a way, is there any standardized way of distinguishing learning objects that can be used in a classroom environment as compared to learning objects that can be used in e-learning or in a standalone mode? I believe that was the essence of the question. And the short answer is no, and the long answer is yes. And let me explain by what I mean by that. There is, to my knowledge, no generally recognized industry-wide way of distinguishing between these two types of uses. But what that means, and this is why it's the longer answer, what that means is you have to look at the properties of the resource that you are considering for use. There are a lot of digital or learning objects out there that were built, particularly by commercial companies, that comply with the ADL and the SCORM guidelines, or the standards, I guess. And so when you look at one of those, you know that it's going to have learning objectives, you know that it's going to pace students through a pre-designed lesson, and consequently, because the learning object used that design, you can infer that it would be used in a standalone e-learning context rather than in a classroom. So the long answer is yes. If you understand enough about learning objects, you are able to find them by their characteristics, but there's no industry-wide way of delineating between the two.
La
I love questions like that. The question was, what would be the next step? After everything I've talked about, what would be the next step for people who are designing complex learning objects in Flash and Adobe and things like that? Look, if you know how to design objects in Flash and these other Adobe products, you have a valuable and highly marketable skill, and I'm not going to recommend that you stop doing it. I would say that in the thinking that you do when you're designing these multimedia objects, think of these. This is a hard thing to express, so I need to be careful. Ask yourself, when you're designing these things, and try to put it in one sentence even, or even one word if you can, what you're trying to say with this resource, with this animation. You've got something very complex, very detailed, and it does a lot of things, but you want to ask yourself, what is the one sentence message that is conveyed by this resource? And the reason why I say it like that is because you need to understand how this resource is going to be used. And in the traditional picture, this resource will be used in a very structured, formal system. It will be set up or introduced by an instructor. The instructor may well describe to the students what they're expected to learn from it. Or it might be delivered in the context of a learning management system in an online course, right? And so it'll be surrounded with a lot of supportive material. But in this new environment, your learning resource might be blogged, right? A student might encounter your learning resource, and if you've given them permission, they might say, this is a great learning resource, and they might just blog it. And people do that now. I mean, there are lots of Flash things, mostly they're games, but that's the way things are these days. There are lots of Flash objects out there, and they show up as a one-line sentence in a blog. Take a look at this thing, click here, and you click there, and there's the resource that you've designed all by itself. No teacher, no course, no anything. And what happens is that these communities of bloggers, communities of people who send emails to each other, people who make posts on discussion boards, they use these objects to comment back and forth to each other. Yeah, just to comment on the state of the world or what they've learned today or whatever. We don't know what people talk about. And so what they will do is they will treat your multimedia object as though it were a word or a sentence in a conversation. Right? And so now your creation is standing there all by itself, all alone, conveying some meaning. And nobody has introduced the meaning. So now you have to ask yourself, if my object was sent from one person to another with no support, what is the sentence that it would say? Is it, will people learn from it? Is it a, sometimes they're jokes? Is it a game where they have some sort of concept? There's always a message, there's always a meaning, a semantics to the resource as a whole. And that's the design frame that you need to take and keep in mind. And when you have that frame, that will lead you to the way that you need to organize and internally structure the resource. Again, it's a very short answer to a very long, long subject. I recommend you look at a paper I wrote called, an introduction. I think it's an introduction to connective knowledge. If you Google the phrase connective knowledge, you will find that paper under my name. And that'll talk a bit more about the meaning and the semantics of standalone multimedia objects working in a network. I hope that helps. I know it wasn't the best answer, but it's a strange environment that we're in. Okay, first of all, you have to tell me where Barenka Yi, I'm sorry. How do you pronounce that?
Barranquilla.
Barranquilla.
Right.
Where is that?
That's the
North Coast. The North Coast, okay. Hello, Barranquilla. I just wanted to know where you were, because I like to know where people are. I don't know why. The question was, would I recommend that people design to the SCORM standards when they are designing learning objects? And the answer is, it depends on what you're using the learning objects for. If you are selling your content to the United States military, you must design according to those standards. Well, hey, it could happen. You know, all you need is a computer and some software and imagination, and you too can be a supplier to the U.S. military. It's a big industry. Also, if you are creating learning objects, especially for companies, like Cisco or any of these large companies or organizations that use a learning management system. So if you're in a commercial market producing things for this environment, then you should follow the standards that particular LMS uses, which will typically be SCORM, not necessarily. This is the way the world of standards works, right? Everybody agrees on the standard, and then each company breaks the standard in its own unique way. Welcome to the world of standards on the internet. So if, on the other hand, you are creating learning resources for your own school or your own community or for use by teachers across Colombia, then I think that complying to the SCORM standards would involve a great deal of effort that is not necessary for this particular context. You have to look very closely at who you're designing for, and that tells you whether or not you should be using those standards.
Y la última pregunta de esta sesión también es de Barranquilla. La pregunta es si se ha hecho alguna evaluación de los resultados de aprendizaje de sus alumnos.
I have not personally conducted such an evaluation, and the question was, I'm sorry people on audio, have I evaluated the use of learning by blogs? I personally do not do that research because I do mostly design and software, which I write badly, but I am in contact with people who do evaluate that. The evaluations have been more or less formal. The reports that are coming in now are mostly anecdotal. There have not been empirical studies. And again, I could give you a short answer to a long question on the evaluating of learning results, but I won't do that. But suffice to say, at this point in time, the anecdotal results coming from the early adopters of blogs in a classroom setting, both in Canada, the United States, and Europe, is that it does change the learning. In some types of learning, it's less effective for memorization and rote and things like that. But for deeper learning, if you move higher up Bloom's taxonomy, for evaluative learning, for the learning of concepts, and higher order types of learning. I'm looking for a word in my mind. It starts with an A, and it's just not there. That happens sometimes. They're very effective. There's there's a paper by Conrad Glagowski that I referenced on my own website about a week ago that talks about the impact of learning objects in a classroom. As well, I would recommend a recently published book by Will Richardson that also looks at the use of blogging in a classroom environment. So my perspective, like I said, I don't do the evaluation things myself, but my perspective is that the initial reports are very positive, but we are going to find, for sure, some limitations in the applications of blogging and learning. I think there's no question about that. That's a good question.
Le agradecemos entonces al Dr. Don por su intervención.